Welcome back. This is Category 5 Technology TV. Once again, tonight I'm joined by Robert Capps. You remember him from previous shows. He is a world-famous expert on data privacy. He is the VP and authentication strategist for New Data Security. Robert, it is so nice to see you again.
Thank you. Thanks for the intro.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Now, you were here. Now, it's hard to believe. I mean, time flies. It's been a year ago in February. You were here on episode 492, and we talked about something called two-factor authentication. And we realized through the course of that discussion, Robert, that two-factor authentication, while possibly a good strategy to data privacy, is not enough when it comes to protecting our data. Before that, we also had you on. We talked about a hack that occurred at a casino here in Ontario, Canada, and that was back on episode number 479, if you want to go back. But tonight, boy, oh boy, this one's big. I think I should just kind of let you talk a little bit about TimeHop and what has happened at TimeHop just as of
Sure. Yeah. So what happened at TimeHop is they've had a data breach. We've heard data breaches constantly in the news these days. It's every day you open the paper, or I guess those who get papers, you open your web browser and you see a lot of information about this company was breached, this company was breached, this company was breached. It's a daily occurrence. And at this point, there's more data out there on internet users than there are humans on the internet, or even on the planet, right? There are more records that have been released in data breaches than there are humans here on Earth. And so with that sort of numbers in mind, looking at what happened with TimeHop is actually not quite as big as some of the others. They lost 21 million consumer records. That's a drop in the bucket compared to some of the other organizations. But what was really impactful here is it wasn't just a name and an email address and maybe a password. It was a phone number, and it was a date of birth. It might have been their gender, their nationality, and those sort of data points. And that's a little more impactful when you think about how this data is used once it's stolen. Stolen data is often used for account takeovers. You know, if they get a username and a password, they go out and they try to log into a bunch of different websites across the internet and see where they work. That shouldn't work, except the consumers aren't real good about keeping unique usernames and passwords for each one of the sites they access.
Now, Robert, you mentioned something that you hit on here is that we're seeing this happen over and over and over again. It seems a theme here at Category 5 Technology TV that we're constantly reporting on this site has been hacked, this user database has been compromised. Why is it that all of a sudden this is happening?
Well, it's been happening for a long time. What we've seen is that the regulations being put out by different nationalities or different organizations are forcing the disclosure of data breaches in a much more profound way. And so where once these things got swept under the rug, we now have data breach discovery and disclosure laws on the books here in the U.S. There's a number of laws at the state level and federal level. Recently in Europe, we have GDPR, which really mandates that if there's any exposure to consumers' information, it has to be disclosed in a very timely manner. And this is actually one of the first breaches that's occurred publicly where GDPR played a central role in the timing of that breach's disclosure. And actually, interestingly enough, if you read the blog post TimeHop put out there, and let me say, they did a fantastic job catching the issue and resolving it quickly and getting the information out to their consumers. But what we did see is that there's a lot of confusion, and they talked about it in their blog post, about what do we need to do? How do we need to do this? There were lawyers involved over the weekend. It was a 4th of July week, and
isn't that always the way?
It's always during a holiday.
The staff has got the long weekend off, and guess what?
And the smaller organizations tend to have fewer security staff. And if one of them is out on vacation, and it sounds like that happened on this situation as well, that can delay understanding the full scope of the issue. And that is what happened. They had to come out with a subsequent release saying that there were date of birth and other data points that were in the data breach that they found out after they started going and doing all of the forensics on the attack. That happens. I've been behind the scenes during data breach recoveries, and you get in there and go, okay, well, we think the problem's here. And then you start looking, and it's over here too, and it's over here too, and you start culminating piece by piece the data that's been stolen. You get into a position where you can only disclose what you know, and you might have to disclose again and again as you find more and more information. That happened in this situation.
And then in the news, it comes across as more. And, we hear about it with Facebook, and it seems like more and more, and it just keeps happening. I'm not a TimeHop user. And so as someone who doesn't use TimeHop, and viewers are asking, how does this affect me? I think there are two facets to this type of data breach. One, obviously, we're going to have to talk about, Robert, the impact that this has on TimeHop users. But for those of us who are not using that particular service, there's also the recognition and the understanding that we gain from these types of breaches that we really need to learn to secure our online profiles. We need to be a lot more conscious of our privacy and security. So we do, if you're watching this right now live and you're wondering, how does this impact me? Just keep in mind that, hey, this is one particular data breach. But I think that there are, what we're learning here tonight with Robert Capps is transcending TimeHop and into various platforms. I mean, it just keeps happening, right? We're going to hear about the next one tomorrow.
Yeah, and the data that's being stolen is often being intermingled from different data breaches and compared. And what they do is they create deeper and deeper profiles for consumers that can then be used later on for other sorts of attacks, whether that's account takeover, identity theft, or any number of other things like synthetic identity assertions, where we're starting to see people's identities being piecemealed together, different people, there's different socials, date of births, and addresses, things are put together to create a new identity that then is used to try and get credit and eventually open accounts in that new person's name. That's a problem too, right? So, as more and more data gets out there, there's more and more useful data for the fraudsters to attack the financial and retail systems. And I think that's the kind of thing that we're starting to see here, is that this data is culminating together. Now they're starting to use it in different ways. What's particularly troubling about attacks on social media aggregation sites is that social media has a lot of contextual information that an attacker needs to understand their mark, their victim, the person they're going after. Right. That information, like mother's maiden name, maybe cousin's name, is the color of a car. A lot of that data exists in social media, even if you have that locked down to just you and your friends. Products like TimeHop, and there's a number of other companies out there that archive social media or do other things with social media posts that you put out there, they have access to that information without having access to your logins. What happens is when you register your account with one of these aggregators, they reach out to the social media platform, they get a token to be able to do specific actions as you without having your username or password. And in this situation with TimeHop, those tokens were stolen, which could have been used for pulling additional data about those consumers down and archiving it. Now, based on the blog post that TimeHop put out there, they've worked with their social media partners to figure out if there was any of that sort of scraping that's occurred. And it doesn't sound like it did. But as you look at some of the security techniques that are being put in place, and privacy blocks are being put in place at social media outlets to keep data within their networks. These are natural next attack points for getting the information that has long been available to these aggregators and these bad guys.
So for the users who say, oh, well, my online profiles, it's nothing private. I don't post anything online. You talk about account takeovers. Is this something that I need to be concerned with if I would define myself as one of those people?
I, cognizant of risk versus concern, online transactions are still far safer than some types of physical transactions. If you think about the protections you're afforded by using your credit card when you purchase products online, you have almost zero liability and zero risk for those transactions, even if you interact with somebody that maybe wasn't the best merchant. You're financially, you'll be made whole by your financial institution due to the regulations, at least here in the U.S. Other countries, you know, your regulations may vary, but most of North America is pretty much aligned in that respect. What I think we're going to be seeing here, what I think we need to be discussing with consumers is taking the right steps to protect themselves. So, you know, when a consumer logs into a new site or creates a new profile, don't use the same username and password they use at other sites. I know that's a tough one. Using password managers on your computer helps. I do have a friend who is ultra secure in his mindset. He has a password journal. It's a physical journal. He writes his passwords in, and when he changes them, he scratches them out for the next one. And the thing's always on him. Yeah. He never leaves it anywhere. But, you know, these are we're always told don't write your passwords down. I think some of that dogma that we've used over the years has really put us in a bad position when it's really forced consumers to do the wrong thing. And what they end up doing is the easiest thing, which is reuse of usernames and passwords. It is perfectly okay to write those things down as long as you keep them secure. It's perfectly okay to use digital password wallets on your computer or your phone as long as you maintain the security of those devices and you keep strong passwords on those password stores. They're going to be good tools for helping you keep your digital life straight and keep your accounts secure. Key accounts to keep control over: social media. You can be used to pull data about you and to impersonate you online. Uh-huh. Bank account records, alternate payment systems, PayPal's and companies like that. Your email account. People don't understand that their email account is the gateway to their access to other sites. If you go and forget your password for Facebook, or you go forget your password for some merchant site, they're going to email you a new password. And so once your email account has been compromised, it is the gateway to taking over other sites, right? other access to other sites that
and
you may have.
When we spoke about two-factor authentication last year, a lot of sites that have two-factor authentication, while it's a great service, they do what? They send your two-factor authentication link. By phone or by email, right. Even.
Yep.
And
exactly.
So, you know, that just, if they have access, if you've used the same password across the platform that was compromised plus your email account, now all of a sudden they've got access to your 2FA as well.
Right.
So back to TimeHop. If I was a user of TimeHop, and there are viewers who are users of TimeHop, what, you mentioned that there was a lot of data stolen and some of this is private information, stuff that you would rather keep absolutely private. What was actually stolen here?
So name, email address, phone number, date of birth. They also had gender designation. And then there was the possibility of some nationality, or at least where you're coming from. What was also stolen were the tokens that were representative of the logins that you'd provided to log into Facebook, whatever social media TimeHop was accessing on your behalf. The good news is that as soon as the identification of the issue happened at TimeHop, they invalidated all those tokens. And so that was the right thing to do.
Yep.
So as a user of TimeHop, you're secure. You should probably go and change your TimeHop password as normal, just in case something happened in regards to the passwords. There's no indication that's what happened, but good practice. Change your passwords, guys. And then you can reestablish your connection to your Facebook, whatever it happens to be. One thing to keep in mind, though, and this is actually best practice for consumers, go out there and check on your social media sites and see what has access to your social media. You'd be surprised. You go to Facebook, you go to Twitter, you go to the other platforms. Almost all of them have a way for you to go and look what applications have access to your data on their, the platform, and you can revoke it and you can remove, you know, do those sort of things. get in a regular habit of going in and seeing what you have what has access to your data, and turn it off if you're not using it anymore. And in the cases where they've archived a bunch of data about you, you might reach out and ask for your data to be deleted if that's an option, or close your account if you're not using those accounts anymore, or whatever it happens to be. But for the most part, do a little spring cleaning here and there, and make sure that you're not giving up your data to just any organization because you forgot you gave them permission 6 months or a year ago.
Right. And the other thing that we have to consider, I think, Robert, is that companies get bought all the time. Mm-hmm. Apps trade hands. And yes. So if we've authorized an app to have access to our Facebook or our Twitter profiles, and then 4 years later we don't even use that app and we don't even remember having used that app, well, how do we know if the same company even owns it, if they're using it for the same purposes, but they still have access to all that information and our profile itself. So if two-factor authentication isn't enough, as we've established on the show previously, if usernames and passwords are simply not enough, what is next? What can we do as users, and what can companies do to help protect private information?
Right. So, I can give you a little bit about what my organization does without pushing the sales button too hard. There are things you can do around consumer behavior, right? They tend to come back and interact with the same sites at the same time of the day. They tend to use the same kind of computer, the same kind of browser. When they log in, they use the same cadence of keystroke. They're using the same username, the same password time and time again on that site, hopefully not shared anywhere else. They're using the same devices. They're coming from the same internet connection. There's enough data points about that consumer as they're interacting to make a judgment call as to whether or not it really is them that's logging in and not somebody that just happened to have their credentials. That in itself is enough to strongly protect consumers, I would say about 80 to 90% of the time.
Oh, wow.
Beyond that point, you really start getting into physical biometric verification, so iris scans, selfies, fingerprints, voice print. There's some other modalities of physical biometrics that are now becoming normal in use online for next point up or step up authentication.
So are these ways to access accounts, or are these a form of two-factor authentication?
Well, that's kind of one and the same. So for two-factor authentication, they are additional factors, albeit ones with more friction and take a little more consumer effort. So they should be saved for the points where frictionless authentication doesn't work or isn't appropriate. Like it's just there's not enough data to make a judgment call. You step up to the next frictionful experience for the consumer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you keep stepping through the things you have in your toolbox to authenticate users. Until you can't, right? At that point, you really have to question whether or not you're dealing with the right person.
So is this kind of what's coming to mind here for me is the new Google reCAPTCHA, how it uses a kind of an intelligence engine to learn if the interaction that I'm making with a website is human or potentially a robot, and if it isn't quite sure, then it asks me to identify the cars and identify the signs. So are these the kinds of technologies that we should be implementing?
I think that there's actually technology that goes beyond that, right? So we've been producing technology that goes beyond putting captchas in front of consumers for a long time. Captchas in front of a consumer it means something didn't work.
Yeah. Okay.
If you put anything technology wise like a captcha in front of a consumer, you failed to identify them as a human up to that point passively. You should probably go back to your human detection drawing board and figure out how to work that one out. Mm. We started off with a smart captcha back in 2011 or 2012, and very quickly figured out that if you put the captcha in there, you failed. And if you've identified them passively, you've been able to not put friction in front of the consumer and basically not tip your hand as to how you're managing to identify those consumers versus the bots. Mm-hmm. That makes your investment technology go a lot further when they can't quite figure out what's going on. From the capture perspective, it's cool for them to figure out whether or not you're human, but they've got a long way to go because they keep showing those captures to people.
Okay, so biometrics, on the other hand, where I have to identify myself with a thumbprint, or I think about the failure that we've seen in things like facial recognition, being able to open phones by a picture or an audio recording. Are these even going to be, or are they already effective ways of authenticating a user?
Well, I wouldn't start there, right? So there's
right, okay.
There's multiple kinds of biometrics. There's passively collected biometrics, and these are things like keystrokes. These are things like if you're holding a mobile device, I've got one somewhere around here. If you're holding your mobile device and you're using it, you tend to use it at a certain angle in a certain hand, and that information is available through the sensors in the device that allows you to profile how that consumer usually holds the device, right? Because my arm's a certain length, my eyesight is a certain way. I've got the glasses off right now because there's glare on the screen. But when I'm looking at my device without my glasses, it tends to be up here. If I've got my glasses on, it tends to be down here, and I'm comfortably looking at it. There's an angle to that, right? And there's a certain amount of distance between my eye and the device, and as it comes up closer, the angle changes. All those data points can be collected in real time during an interaction, anonymized, of course. They can't say that this is Robert, but they can say that this is the human that normally interacts with this account. And from that perspective, you can strongly identify someone even with physical aspects of their body and how they interact. You can do that without violating consumer privacy or being creepy or anything else right. that goes along with that. But you can do it in a friction-free way that allows the consumer just to do what they want to do naturally without having to go to those multi-factor, fingerprints and iris scans.
Right.
Getting back to the question on using non-live recordings of those biometrics, that's a concern. And there are technologies that are being used to mitigate some of those issues in consumer electronic devices. So things like Face ID with Apple, they're projecting dots all over the face and they're measuring the actual movement and the distribution of those dots on the face in order to make sure that you're actually a 3D representation of you.
Oh.
And so that isn't going to be subject to a photo being used to get around it. But it could be subject to a mask. Now, we saw that someone built a proof of concept mask and they spent thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars breaking Face ID. What they really did was prove that if you spend a lot of money, you could probably break a consumer biometric product. But the cost to do that and the heavy lifting to get it done, you had to get a 3D image of the person's face and you had to be able to print it with enough fidelity and have to have somebody's head that was small to fit into it that didn't distort it. That's a lot of ifs in order to actually break those technologies.
Now, Madame Tussauds might beg to differ.
And, that's true. Yeah.
Do I need to be concerned if I was some big executive rep in a company that represents millions of customers and billions and billions of dollars? Do I need to be concerned now with biometric data of things like, and I hate to say it, but like if someone wants to steal that data, do I need to worry that my fingers are going to get stolen or, those kinds of things? Is that going to be something that is a new concern in this world where we use biometric data?
Yeah, I mean, the way we're using it right now with consumers is mostly as convenience. It's a convenient mechanism to prove physical activity or physical presence in the transaction. We do have not just anecdotal evidence, but actual evidence of crime gangs abducting people in other countries for exactly that situation you're talking about.
Yep.
This is not a normal thing. It does not occur on a daily basis. This is not something the average consumer should have to worry about. This is where, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars were at stake, and they needed somebody's fingerprints to do something. Like that, it's movie theater plots.
Yeah.
We don't see those happen in reality that much. That one you spoke of actually does have some actual reality base to it, but it's such a rare, not just a rare, they're abnormal
okay.
situations. Yeah.
All right. So yes, I need to be worried.
Well, if you're a multi-trillionaire, then you should have a bodyguard anyway.
Which I'm not, but I do think about folks who got in on the Bitcoin game real early and have very real concerns of having their accounts compromised. And those kinds of people have, you know, very real threats that come to them. So this all sounds, as you say, the consumer doesn't really need to be quite as concerned, but it does sound more like these are things that big companies like Amazon or eBay should be implementing. What about us smaller online e-commerce sites? And like, is there a transcendence of these types of services that we can start to use as well?
Yeah, so passive biometrics and behavioral analytics are available to small mom-and-pop web shops. The technology there is as simple as some JavaScript and some additional components that go on the application server, and then some web services calling data around in order to get intelligence and provide you, am I dealing with a human? Am I dealing with the right human? That's accessible to everybody who has a website, and not for a tremendous amount of money. As you get into physical biometrics, you need to have some additional technology built into your native mobile app, which means you have to have a native mobile app. You start getting into the realm of technologies that get a little more expensive or a lot more complicated to deploy. The passive stuff is pretty easy, and it gets you the vast majority of your customers secured in a way that they just weren't prior to deployment of a technology like that. For now, though, most of the large issues, most of the fraud issues that are occurring against the large organizations at scale. And so if you have a small organization starting to have some fraud issues or can't take over issues, putting these sort of technologies we're talking about, the passive biometrics, behavioral analytics products out on their site, will solve for a tremendous number of their issues.
That sounds fantastic. Now, you mentioned JavaScript code availability and things like that. Where can I get it?
New Data has it.
I certainly don't mind. I mean, if that's what you guys are doing, then we need to check out newdatasecurity.com and learn more about the technology that is available to us there. I've been speaking tonight with Robert Capps. He is the VP and authentication strategist for New Data Security. Robert, always a pleasure having you here. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your expertise, and we look forward to the next time as well.
Have a great afternoon.
Take care.